Morning!
Morning!
Welcome to the India Explained podcast, recorded in London and San Francisco. One take, unscripted, no rehearsal.
Hey, Bunty. Greetings from San Francisco. It's midweek. We're actually doing an episode on the COVID crisis, as we discussed. We had another episode, but that was, I think, before the U.S. Decided to share some supplies. And as we had predicted in the episode, they, after saying no, they would say yes. But anyway, what happened is, long story short, things changed for the better. The international communities bandied together. But for today's episode, we thought we'd talk about how news of the crisis is actually being censored in India by a range of actors. So what are your thoughts on that, taking off, Bunty?
Look, I think it's odd to do the podcast midweek, Rohit, because it's a bright Thursday, and it stays light pretty late. You know, we are getting tiptoeing into summer, which is a good thing. So, but back to the point, how is information playing itself out at a personal level, Rohit? I have been on and off social media intermittently. Like, I have not had a Twitter account. I am not on Facebook. I don't say this with any pride. It's just that, I haven't managed to get my act together to be on these mediums. Instagram, I periodically peruse. But WhatsApp is something, I think that still classifies as social media. I am there, and I'm kind of nominally active there. And in terms of accuracy of information and rumor mongering, and the lack of fact checking, there's a lot of shit flowing around in WhatsApp. Some to do with prevention of COVID. So there's like a plethora of home remedy, COVID home remedy, like smell camphor, look to the east, chew tulsi, a lot of that kind of thing. Then there is this kind of gradual dialing up of panic around, muhalla mein oxygen khatam ho gaya. Acha, muhalla mein oxygen khatam ho gaya, tera kya jata hai? If you need oxygen, then it's only a matter of concern. So a lot of those kind of needless middle class panicking has happened. But the other thing that has been become apparent is gradually, it's like this ever-rising tide of bed shortages, and there is a genuine scarcity of oxygen. What I'm trying to convey to you is there are mixed messages. Not mixed. There is a uniform message that there is not enough ICU beds, there is not enough oxygen. That's the message that I'm getting, whether social media, my use, or normal media. But what I'm getting very irritated by is like middle-class, well-to-do panic about things that they don't need. And I think there's an interesting piece that got circulated, which is how middle-class, upper-middle-class people in India are basically taking anticipatory treatment, right? So they are monitoring, they are getting fancy gadgets to monitor oxygen levels. And then rather than present themselves at hospital or take the necessary actions when they need it, they are essentially waddling into hospital with like 60, like when their oxygen levels is 90%. Denying a person who's literally gasping at 50, 46%. That's the kind of stories I'm picking up. But that's at a very macro level. So what are the things that you are picking up?
Well, I think first, there is a genuine crisis, and it is a humanitarian crisis. And it's a crisis of gargantuan proportions. And it's a crisis that's the result of incompetence over, I would say, a year. There's a video of Modi at Davos earlier this year, I think, in January, talking about how the world had written India off, but we persevered, and et cetera, et cetera. And that was probably the reason of just sheer dumb luck combined with maybe some practices being followed well, social distancing and so on. And the fact that I think we were building up to this over a period of time, a lot of COVID-related deaths because of comorbidity in rural areas and so on weren't reported as such. I think the situation is very, very dire. And then, yes, in the last couple of months, as the vice president, I think, of the Indian Medical Association has said, he called Modi a super spreader. This electioneering at all costs, election bazi, large rallies, the Kumbh Mela and all, these have kind of lit a fuse under this COVID tinderbox. Now what's happened is that the government is panicking. I think Amit Shah and Modi are both, they're out of their depth here. There's just no two ways about it. And that holds for, politicians from other parties as well. I think Arvind Kejriwal is also out of his depth. I think, Calcutta is a mess. And again, to some extent, perhaps the electioneering is to blame. But, you know, the TMC also engaged in it. I think there was a statistic going around that one in two people in Calcutta has this. In the face of this, there are several things that different central and state ministers are doing. One is that on request from the Modi government, Twitter has banned or shadow banned or geo-blocked 50 Twitter accounts. And these are not random, untraceable accounts, you know, emanating from some troll factory in Eastern Europe, which can then be traced back to an opposition party. These are legitimate tweets about Modi's culpability, about the state of the terrible state of affairs, the failure of governance that opposition leaders, including in the Congress, put out. And I believe one of them has actually sued Twitter or has, you know, served Twitter legal notice. But Jack Dorsey of Twitter, of course, does not want to lose the Indian market. And we know, you know, for a long time that there's one set of standards for the BJP and the Hindu right and the Hindu right trolls, and another set of standards for everyone. The hashtag Modi resigns has been blocked in India. Journalists shared that. And to give you one example, in UP, there's a gentleman who just shared or just put out a request for oxygen for his father. He didn't even mention the phrase Twitter. Now, shortly after Adityanath, I don't even want to call him Loki, because there's some, you know, that can still denote some respect. And I don't think that man is deserving of respect. So Dhongi Adityanath, or Adityanath, if you will, after initially insisting there is no shortage of oxygen in UP, then went ahead and, you know, filed an FIR. His government filed an FIR against the man. There's a longer backstory to this, right? We remember the story of this doctor called Kafil Khan, who had sort of spilled the beans. He was a whistleblower about a shortage of oxygen leading to the deaths of, you know, large numbers of babies in the UP hospital. So, you know, there's a couple of larger points I'll make, which is related to all of this, and then turn it over to you. One, that at a time like this, preventing people from speaking up is, it's just absolutely reprehensible and appalling. Threatening the Indian media and telling them, you know, give positive news, which is a way of saying don't criticize the government. It again boils down to this completely repulsive kind of narcissism that Modi has, which has already cost India dearly. And I think, you know, if you look at what he did with just the aggression with Pakistan and China, with demonetization, he is a man who is willing to take decisions that result in the loss of life if he can get political capital and if he can keep the sheen on his image. So it's absolutely pathetic. And, you know, the truth will out. How do you control the fire from, you know, bodies that are being burned? You have these drone shots. You have makeshift crematories in all over Delhi and in other, you know, in Lucknow and so on. The condition is actually really very severe. And the international media, God bless them. You know, they'll, of course, be accused by the hyper-nationalist trolls of being anti-Modi, anti-Hindu, anti-India, etc. The international media is reporting. And while this is not the time for, you know, there's no sort of triumph in any of this, I want to be very clear about this, but it does occur to me that the same people who spend their time abusing, you know, Bangladesh and other countries with Muslim populations, now suddenly, you know, you may be a Bhakt or a, you know, Hindu fanatic, you have no problem taking oxygen from UAE. So maybe when the dust settles, you know, some reflection, I think, would be in order.
Look, I think we feel that in our own small way, that this kind of hide and seek that the government of India has been playing, and lately the state government has been playing with facts. I had long suspected, Rohit. A friend of mine observed very astutely. He said to me that, look, this infection has been running. So when Modi was doing his chest thumping in Davos, he was saying, boss, UK with a population of 75 million has clocked up 125,000 deaths. Right? Ballpark, India's population is about 20 times of the UK. Right? Yeah. Now, it is inconceivable that the fatality rates are as they are being reported, because one of two things is happening. Either it is being underreported, or in a classic dubious fashion, it is not qualifying as a death due to COVID, right? So that kind of man-management happened. And I think that is what gave the provided kind of the tailwind for the Gujarati game plan, which is that I can keep bullshitting people as long as I can massage the numbers, right? Where the Gujju game plan got undone was when the death and suffering overtook this kind of number management.
You're right. It reached a tipping point. Absolutely.
Yeah. It reached a tipping point. And now what has happened is they are trying the more cruder elements. So previously they thought, because each of these basically people who have these kind of right-leaning tendencies see themselves as pocket Chanakyas, where actually basically they're like low-grade thugs, right? So they have kind of imbibed this like massive analytical superiority and they can see the story coming and how they can manage. But essentially, when events overtake them, they look like the idiots they truly are. And what has happened is, unfortunately, in this case, events have overtaken and they are running out of plausible explanation. Because, you know, if you can't put on a like, I have defeated China, plausible explanation, the territory is being occupied by China, how have you defeated China?
Boss, you absolutely took the words out of my mouth. You know, it's interesting that after we had the conversation last week, and we had actually a very good conversation about the international response, you know, there's a number of things you said that got me thinking during the week. And one of the things I was thinking of is that if I were to come down to, you know, identifying one difference, key difference between Modi and Manmohan Singh, Manmohan Singh didn't need an enemy to basically be who he was. Modi cannot exist without an enemy. And this is why, you know, Pakistan, China, black money, Muslims, Dalits, one enemy after liberals, secular, award wapsi gang, international media. But you're right that to me, the amazing thing is that are these followers, are they members of a cult? This is what my mom was telling me yesterday. She said, you know, in the face of all of this happening, still on WhatsApp groups, and I see this with people I know as well, they still, their way of defending Modi is to, you know, dig up one article about Arvind Kejriwal's failure, one thing that Mamta did, so conveniently blame it on the state governments. But you're absolutely right. And it was China, you know, at this rate, I have a feeling that in another 3 months, China is going to be in Madhya Pradesh, and after that, they're going to be in Rajasthan. Then you claim about China, listen. Pakistan also, boss, we shot a crow. We bombed a field and we shot a crow. We lost a pilot. And under international pressure, that pilot was returned by Imran Khan. So then we are claiming that, you know, ghar mein ghuske mara and this, that, these like, you know, kind of low-level B-grade, Mithun-level film lines. But the question is, now that you're faced with a pandemic, you have a real enemy, you have completely utterly failed.
Correct. When the going got tough, the Gujus went scrambling. I mean, look, I keep saying Gujju. I'm not casting aspersion on anybody, everybody from Gujarat. All I'm saying is I'm using it as a shorthand to reference a few political, a school of political thinking that has emerged, which may be enemy-based, as you've kind of taken up a line that if without an enemy, you are lost. It's adversarial. It could also be like Alex Ferguson was massively known in the footballing circle at his peak. That irrespective of what the results were, Ferguson would always think Manchester United were being victimized, right? Playing the victim thing, right? And finding enemies in the press, in the establishment, in the southern London clubs, etc. So I think a bit of that is going on. But okay, back to the point. I digress. I think in the middle of all of this chaos, where should people turn for correct information and correct facts? I think one of the refreshing things that has happened to me is in social media, in WhatsApp feeds in itself. So there's a cadre of WhatsAppers who are essentially regurgitating misinformation. That misinformation is about, you know, whether you jam Chyawanprash up your backside to get fit, or, you know, look to the east and do something in a particular order. So there's that cadre of WhatsAppers. Then there's another cadre of WhatsAppers who are ground up trying to tell them people where is oxygen available. Where is a hospital bed empty, right? And you're seeing this interesting juxtaposition of people passing around useful, local, fact-checked information, which is really helping people who are, you know, literally running door-to-door to try and save loved lives. And on the other hand, you have this cadre of people who are, you know, why should you vaccine? Vaccine will be triple in price. Actually, the other day I saw a vaccine, somebody saying that, you know, they are actually pretending to vaccinate you. They are not vaccinating. So all kinds of nonsense But I'm saying in all of this, there is a 30%, and this is a ballpark percentage, of people who are genuinely trying to inform other people of help, trying to stand by people in times of difficulty. And so I think there is hope. Not everything is doom and gloom. You know, the politician and politics is very bad.
I agree with you. First I'll just speak to a couple of points you made, that I don't think your, invocation of the Guju political style is in any way discriminatory. The thing is that for years people have praised the so-called Gujarat model, right? We know Gujarat has been a laboratory of Hindutva, but Gujarat was also kind of test run for the Modi political model. And the so-called success story of Gujarat was completely a myth. You know, there's a very well-known sociologist, Ghanshyam Shah, from Gujarat. There's other academics, there's people who work in the NGO sector on the ground. For years, they've said that the situation in Gujarat has actually been horrendous. And in some ways, it was kind of a dry run for a planned marginalization of, Muslims and minorities in the rest of India. And you could not, for instance, in a university in Gujarat, criticize Modi, because the state authorities would clamp down and they would hold the principal or, someone senior in that university responsible. So part of the Gujarat model was along the lines of the Soviet Union, control of information. And I remember some, many years ago, there were some statistics about malnutrition in Gujarat, which essentially questioned the fact that Gujarat was, prosperous, or that the average person in Gujarat was getting adequate nutrition. And a number of economists who themselves, they have political ambitions, they aligned with the Modi government, they came up with the absurd explanation that Indians are actually, shorter. The average Indian child is shorter than the average Western child, and that's what's happening here. This is not malnutrition. And my boss says, choro yaar, you take a look at that child and you know that this is someone who has not got adequate nutrition. This so-called prosperity of Gujarat was always a myth. But again, once you face something like the pandemic, then the truth comes out. You're absolutely right. I think a lot of people are well-intentioned. I think we have a lot of, excellent and dedicated people, whether it's in the medical field, whether it's, people who work in logistics, whether it's Indian nurses, and there are Indian traditions of, in some ways, helping people in non-transactional ways, which I actually find don't exist in the West. I mean, this is not me doing, this number about, we have some divinity that people in the West don't. I mean, Western systems are amazing in all kinds of ways, but on an individual level, I often find that, even people with whom you've had a long relationship for a while, the limit to that relationship often is transactionality. And I do find, for instance, that some of the older civilizations, and I'm not, getting on some anti-Western rant here, I'm saying that some of the older civilizations, the Chinese, the Indian, these are not perfect civilizations. We have our own, unfortunate histories and legacies of exclusion, but we have this kind of non-transactional aspect to what it means to be human as well. Plus, I think there is a glimmer of hope. I think that the rate of infection and transmission has slowed. The international community, and as Indian, as an Indian, and a person of Indian origin, I'm grateful that for everyone who's helped, Bangladesh has offered to help. India, we had made a lot of awaaz and we had offered some small 500,000 dose, some to Canada, with a lot of grandstanding and chest thumping by Modi. Canada is now coming to our help. The UK has come to our help. The US has. I believe Singapore sent oxygen. Qatar and UAE have. So I think with all of this, things will get better. And I think what happens is that in these networks, once there is someone you personally know, then the chain of transmission of information tends to be accurate. But is there one single public official source that can be relied on? I'm not sure. Because, they're coming up with useless metrics like recovery rate. And of course, when you don't know what the accurate infection and death rate is, what sense does the recovery rate mean, right? And if a third of a million people are getting infected every year, 365,000 every day, one third of a million people are getting officially infected, different public health experts have said that the infection and the death rate, the fatality rate, is anywhere from 3 to 10 times what the government is saying. So it's very possible, and I don't want to spread misinformation here, so I'm saying it's possible I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, of people who are in the field. But public health experts have said that, you know, we may have actual fatalities may already be anywhere from about 1 million to 2 million in India over the last year and a half.
I don't think you're spreading rumors. You just work with basic mathematics. In a country of 100 people, in a country of 10 people, in a country of 10 people, one person has reported ill and died, right? In roughly the same type of illness, right? Barring some variant. How come in a country of 100 people, nobody has reported dead? That's sort of the googly, right? So that scale has been befuddling, that, you know, because Brazil, they have realized that, you know, Brazil wasn't trying to massage the numbers. Bolsonaro is another idiot in another part of the world. He also doesn't believe that COVID exists and shops should close and people should do their bidding. And Brazil's getting rammed, you know, so there's, you know, dead on the streets. But they have never massaged their numbers. So they haven't gone in front of international plenaries wearing dodgy suits, proclaiming that, you know, we are genius uncles. So that's the trip that's going to be taken. It's tragic. You know, I don't want to be calling it for what it is, but it is what it is. Look, any other observations you have on this moment before we wrap?
You know, just that you're letting the international... Well, I have something to say about the Indian media, like show some spine. I mean, you look at the smaller upstart initiatives, and I write for Scroll, I've written for The Wire in the past as well. They're doing, you know, the work that everyone should be doing, but, you know, Times of India, Republic is not even a journalistic organization. The Telegraph has done some, like, yeoman work. Caravan has done excellent work, but other than that, the India Today group and all, you know, one article that is mildly critical of the Modi government, suddenly they'll be like, you know, praise. What is this be positive rubbish, yeah? I mean, yeah, of course you have to be positive, but be positive cannot be code for tell lies and just, you know, make sure you don't say anything about Amit Shah and Modi, because, you know, as and when things get better, and they will, they're going to, you know, have a team of, like, people from the income tax department raiding you and make your life miserable. I mean, do your damn job is my point, right? And hats off to those journalists who are working for either these, smaller Indian ventures. And by the way, The Wire and Scroll have, you know, the Modi government has really gone after them in a vicious and nasty kind of way. And all the good international publications, reputed international publications, whether it's the BBC or, Time or USA Today or whoever. And some of them have people on the ground in India, some don't. Some have, I think, commissioned work from well-known Indian journalists, they are doing India a service also. Nobody is taking any pleasure in reporting this kind of news. This is what journalists do. You tell the news, you tell the truth, right? If there is no space in crematoriums, if graveyards are running out of space, if bodies are piling up, if parking lots have to be converted, well, that is the reality. And the sooner we face the reality, the sooner we can go around, you know, addressing it. But preserving Mr. Modi's image, like, that cannot be a calculation in any kind of ethical, journalistic, venture or task. So that would be my final point. And I just think that, you know, it's the truth needs to prevail. And the truth, you know, is ugly and hard to bear. But that will be the way forward. That's absolutely essential to getting this thing under control.
Look, I think that's a very valid point that you make, that, you know... the only thing that I'll say in that slipstream of what you just observed, Rohit, that now I think there's going to be a season of journalists who will come out and do their job and pretend to be like Bharat Singh, like massive martyrs to the cause. Right?
Yeah, yeah, this is another...
Because for the last 10 years, they've been brown-nosing...
Absolutely. And this is this is something that you had mentioned as well when we just were sort of casually chatting earlier this week. Just for doing your job, please don't expect, you know, some kind of Pulitzer or Indian version, some Goenka Award or something, right? So, for reporting the news, which you should have done for the last 10 years, when instead, you know, you were talking about lying about Modi's waist, saying he doesn't have a paunch, he does IIT sums in his head, he's taught Pakistan a lesson, then you are engaging in that kind of, you know, talve chatna, as it's called, licking feet or being a lick spittle or doing chanchagiri, Now suddenly you're saying that two people have died. That doesn't, like, you know, make you a great journalist. This is your damn job, which you should have done all this while for the last 10 years. And I think this is the time when we should make a distinction between people who've been genuine journalists, Atosh Bal, you know, Mihir Sharma, Naresh Fernandez, the editor of Scroll, the team at Wire, you know, Rana Ayub, Swati Chaturvedi. These are people who've really done a great job. And I, you know, may not agree with everything that each of them says, as opposed to, you know, the other people who are really jokes pretending to be journalists, you know. So that I think is a very, very good point that you've made. And you know, I just hope that, you know, the truth prevails, as I said. And that's our Satyamev Jayate, right? Like that is, you know, part of the you know, kind of the official sort of self-definition of what the values that India claims to stand for. So I think that is absolutely a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for the pandemic to be brought under control in India.
Well said, boss. Chalo, on that note, let's wrap up.
Yeah, let's do that. Take care, man. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Rohit and Bunty would like to sign off. Please stay tuned. Follow us on India Explained on Twitter. Keep listening. Thank you for all your support.